our subject is the creation and preservation of a subject-centered collection of tweets, and our case study will be the revolution that took place in Egypt in early 2011. So what we'll talk about first is just a brief overview of Twitter as a platform and how the perception and the valuation of Twitter has changed over time and how we've reached this point of using it as a data set. Then I'll do a very brief overview of the key API commands that every researcher will need to use to get tweets from the platform, and the preservation principles and the concerns that are derived from doing that. And then Tim's going to take over and talk about the actual decisions made in the collection methodology. And we'll close with some actual examples of tweets from the revolution so you can have a clear idea about the content we're talking about and what's at stake. So first I want to trace the history of Twitter very briefly. You know, as you may recall, back in 2006, 2007, Twitter was largely regarded and derided as a platform for trivial messaging. This is what Richard Rogers, in a great paper called Debanalizing Twitter, would call Twitter One. And this is the status update type of system where you post about your lunch, you post about how nice the park is that you're in, and so on and so forth. It wasn't until a little bit later, with big events that have a wider interest, like elections or disasters, natural or no, that Twitter establishes itself as a newsworthy platform that has significant reporting going on. And you can think about the tweets that are run across the banner of a news network on television, as an example. And finally, there's Twitter 3, which we would term as a data set. And a key example here would be the collecting efforts of the Library of Congress to collect all of the tweets ever published as a massive research data set that can be crunched in the way that we might analyze big data. So we look at big trends like user graphs or tweet graphs or counts of retweets and things like that. And really, all of these uses are rolled into the desire for a subject-centered collection of tweets, everything from status updates to reportage to analyzing things in the aggregate, analyzing trends and so on in the aggregate. And I've glossed that here with the hashtag January25. It's not the only big hashtag that was used for the 18 days in Egypt, but it's one of the most prominent. So I'll talk about the API briefly. Now, of course, it's copiously documented on the website, and for those folks who may be unfamiliar with the term, API refers to application programming interface, and it is the codified way that you interact with Twitter as a platform to get data out of it. Broadly, we have two paths here. There's something called the REST API, and there's another API called the Stream API. The REST API is for moving backwards, getting tweets that have already been published. And there are two prominent ways to do that, or at least two common ways to do that for researchers. The first is search, which you can make, you supply a query to search, and with specified parameters, you can make 180 requests per every 15 minutes, and you get 100 results back per request. So you get 18,000 maximum tweets per 15 minutes. So the extent that you can go back is contingent upon how quickly you get that 18,000. It could be a few hours or it could be up to a week, after which point the tweets become historical. The second method is to identify a specific user. And when you do this, you can get their last 3,200 tweets. And this often provides an opportunity to reach the farthest back into Twitter's history as you can with the REST API. The Stream API is for moving forward. This is, you set a query, you set the parameters, and you tell it to give you all the tweets going forward since you issued the command. Twitter will give you, it says, up to 1% of its fire hose, which is all of the tweets that the service processes at any given time. So, having covered that, what are our preservation risks and principles going forward? So obviously we want to preserve the content. In many cases, this is textual. In other cases, it's going to be linked content to images and moving images. But in the ideal case, we can keep reusing this information. And so we think it's valuable to try and align a Twitter data set with a scientific data set, which is copiously documented and how it's collected so that future users have the right context to be able to use it correctly or in an appropriate way. So I have here a term called a double construction. This is from Niels Brueger and Niels Finneman in their paper, The Web and Digital Humanities. They're referring here to a web archive, but I think it applies equally well to a Twitter archive. What it means is that a collection of tweets that a user might encounter in a repository and archive is really two steps removed from the actual content as it would have been encountered by users in their Twitter clients or via the web interface. It's constructed in two senses. The first is that there's the scoping decisions that the researchers made, the search criteria the users identified. That limits what you can access now. And there's a second construction, and that's the actual manifestation of the tweets as they're presented. Are they rows in a very big spreadsheet? Are they in a searchable database that can't be seen necessarily all at once but has to be queried? Are they returned in the original JavaScript object notation or JSON format? Are they in XML? There's many ways to represent them, but they will all necessarily be much, much different than how they're encountered by the actual users. So our goals in preservation are to contextualize that double construction as much as we can. And the key way that we advocate to do this is to preserve the methodology. So this means preserving the actual scoping decisions that were made by the researchers, so the search terms, the users identified, and of course the reasoning behind those decisions. We also mean any transformations that are made by the researchers, if any metadata fields were dropped, or if any were added, and any changes to the actual form of the tweets. And I think most critically is an effort to bind the tweets that were captured by specific API calls so that future users will understand which tweets came from, for example, the Stream API, and which tweets came from a search query, and which tweets came from a user status investigation and moving back through their timeline. This is really the only opportunity that we have for creating and recording provenance of tweets. There's a lot of the black box, so to speak, in working with Twitter, since all contact with the platform is mediated through Twitter. And even though the APIs have very specific parameters given to users, we ultimately don't know which tweets we get back between one search and another. There are a lot of variables between the network latency and bandwidth, server-side issues, the unique server path that the queries go through, and so on. So it's difficult to repeat these types of data sets, so it's paramount of importance, we think, to document as much as we can which specific API calls came, which specific calls got the tweets that the user's seeing. And that said, I'm going to hand it off to Tim, and he will cover the collection methodology. Tim?
Thank you, Walker. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Well, I'm just going to go ahead with the collection methodology section. And the first question that the major question that we're going to ask in determining collection methodology is, how will you define the scope of your collection? And before answering this question, you must first answer the basic questions that any researcher must ask. And these questions are who, what, where, when, and why. So in order to answer the where question, we have a few options. You can limit your search by location. That is the location that the Twitter user is reporting that they're tweeting from. You can also limit it by time zone. This is also a self-reported. You can limit by geolocation. Not a lot of Twitters actually choose to use the geolocation, so this might not be the best option, particularly if you're going to be collecting from users who are tweeting from a revolution. It may not be in their best interest for everyone to know where they are. In order to answer the when question, we have to think about time, and temporality is very important. For Twitter, event monitoring on Twitter happens very quickly and dies down just as quickly. So it's important to start collecting as soon as possible, as soon as the event happens. So those two questions are relatively easy to answer. Things start to get tricky when we start thinking about the who question. And there are a few different methods in order to answer this question that we broadly define as quantitative and qualitative. Now, it may be within the scope of your collection to collect tweets from, you know, just anyone, anywhere. You know, the who question may not be important to you. But if it is, generally people want to get tweets from people who we are going to call opinion leaders. And in order to determine who these opinion leaders are, we have a quantitative approach and we have a qualitative approach. So in the quantitative approach, the quantitative approach is best if you want to avoid bias. In order to go about limiting the search quantitatively, you can enter your desired search terms into either the search function of the REST API or into the Stream API. And you can enter your tweet returns into a statistical analysis software such as Stata. And then you can decide which criteria you want to use. You can search for the users with the most tweets. You can search for the users who are mentioned the most. You can search for the users who are retweeted the most. And then you can use the REST API to collect the data from the users, from the users' Twitter pages that you identified in the above steps. Now, the qualitative approach is an approach that I prefer. I guess I will never be a good social scientist. I don't really care about bias that much. So if you want to identify opinion leaders qualitatively, you can embed yourself into a community on Twitter. You examine the community's discourse, and you can kind of qualitatively see who is being retweeted or mentioned the most. Opinion leaders often know each other, so when you identify two or three opinion leaders, identifying more becomes much, much easier. And through examining this discourse, you can see who is being included and who is being excluded from their conversation. And once you've identified them, you can use the REST API to collect the tweets from these opinion leaders' Twitter pages. So the next question that you want to ask is the what question. And because of the constraints of the API, a full collection of tweets from a given hashtag may be impossible, particularly for a globally significant event. And for your purposes, an incomplete set might be fine. However, if you identify what we're going to call niche hashtags, you can get not only a full set of tweets, but you can also identify tweets from a particular demographic. And we're going to take a case in point here, and we're going to compare the hashtags Jan25 and the hashtag Horia. So the second hashtag there, the one with the numeral 7, the 7 is actually pronounced as kind of a long H. It's a phoneme that does not exist in European languages, and so it's transliterated as a number 7, and it's like a kind of sound. So Jan25 was the most popular hashtag used during the revolution in Egypt. There was no way for anyone to get a complete set of tweets using this hashtag. Huria, however, is a hashtag that's written in Arabizi, which Arabizi is kind of like, it's basically Arabic written in Latin characters. And the word Huria is, the translation is basically freedom. So if you were to use this hashtag in your search, you would get tweets that were generated from users who had knowledge of both Arabic and English. Another benefit of using niche hashtags is that you will also limit the amount of spam that you get in your collection. Spammers will typically use common hashtags, you know, and just flood them, but they don't generally use niche hashtags as much. In order to identify any hashtag, but niche hashtags in particular, knowledge of vernacular is really key. So we can take, for example, here the difference between the word for president in English, or excuse me, in Arabic, between Egyptian and formal Arabic. So in Egyptian Arabic, the word for president is reis, and in formal Arabic, it is ra'is. And there are different spellings of this word in dialect and formal Arabic. And one of the issues here is that all Arabic dialects, including Egyptian, Moroccan, Levantine, none of them have had formalized spellings up until, like, just right now. Like, dialect was something that was not written, and it has only started to be written with the broad use of social media in the region. So knowledge of how words are being transcribed either in Arabic script or in Latin characters is really key. And you also have to take into account that certain words are different in dialect than they are in formal Arabic. So the word for today, for example, in Egyptian is anharda, and in formal Arabic it's al-yom. You know, so if you were going to do a hashtag for the word, a search for the hashtag for today, and you used al-yom, you would not get very many returns at all if you were focusing on a search in Egypt. And then the last issue that we would like to talk about in terms of your collection is veracity. And there are really three key concerns here. One is that governments will often spread misinformation in order to confuse Twitter users or users who are using Twitter to organize activities on the ground. This was done in Egypt. It was done in the demonstrations after the fraudulent presidential elections in Iran in 2009. So you should be aware that some misinformation will get into your collection. The other issue, of course, is that anonymity allows users to tweet basically without consequence. So any user can say whatever they want, and there's no way to verify what they're saying, whether what they're saying is accurate or not. And even the identity of the user, there's no way to verify that, unless, of course, they go through Twitter's verification process. But this is something that's typically only used for celebrities. So next, I'd actually like to talk about some examples.
Tim, you got about 1 minute.
Yes. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We can just go through these very quickly. So we have here some examples that were pulled together by programmers who are affiliated with the Harvard Web Ecology Project. They pulled together a collection including 4 million tweets that were collected during the 18 days in Egypt. Myself and two sociologist colleagues at the University of California went through this collection and performed content analysis on it. And if you could just go through these slides very quickly, we can take a look at the kinds of tweets that you can expect to collect in a subject-centered collection. So we have calls for collective action. We have tweets that were used for fundraising. We have tweets that indicated transnational solidarity. These were tweets that show support for protesters outside Egypt. We have tweets that allowed proxy server access. These are users outside Egypt who tweeted their IP addresses so that Egyptians could use them to access the internet during the internet blackout. And then we have citizen reportage, which is Twitter users reporting events firsthand. So in conclusion, cultural literacy is critical to collection methodology. And preserving your collection methodology is the key concern for preservation. And if you would like to know more Our research is going to be published in the American Archivist in the fall-winter issue of this year, and the title of that is Preserving the Voices of Revolution. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.